Welcome to NPR's Movie Podcast. As usual, we're sending you our weekly movie love. This week, we talked with filmmaker Wayne Wang about not one, but two movies he has coming out. NPR's Ken Masters tells us we should pull out those funky 3D glasses. Ken Turan reviews Appaloosa, and actor Ed Harris talks about making that movie. But first, the 85th birthday of a classic movie studio.
We're going to look back now at one of the great Hollywood studios with film critic Richard Schickel. He's written a book marking the 85th anniversary of Warner Brothers. It's a history that takes movies from what's considered the first talkie, the jazz singer, through a dizzying array of classics, comedies, noir, westerns, wizards, and superheroes. We met Richard Schickel in Burbank on Warner's back lot. There we stood on a city street where brick shops wound to a courthouse and an elevated train. Buildings with nothing in them except lots and lots of history.
That was the bookshop, that one there, where Humphrey Bogart goes in the big sleep, and Dorothy Malone is in there. Okay. Very young, gorgeous young actress at that time.
Is there something I can do for you?
Would you do me a very small favor?
I don't know, it depends on the favor.
She's the clerk in the store, and they start having dialogue, and they start eyeing each other. Eventually, Bogart says, well, you know, I have a little bottle of rye in the car, and, you know, maybe, and he sort of exits, and she takes the sign and turns it from open to closed.
Looks like we're closed for the rest of the afternoon.
And then they sort of drift into the back room.
Hello.
Hello.
It's amazing, in a way, that we can stand here now and the store is still there.
Well, it's one of the things about this lot. I mean, you know, a lot of the standing sets, I mean, they're just antique. That's the house Jimmy Dean is in East of Eden, you know. So, you know, there's lots of stuff that are touched by the history of movies that were made on the lot that are still here and still functioning. You know, they just redress them and keep using them.
Through all those reused sets and thousands of movies, one constant set Warner Brothers apart. From Hollywood's earliest days, studios like MGM made glossy movies about the upper crust, what Richard Schickel calls white telephone luxe. Escapism was popular during the Depression, and Warner spotted an opportunity. It carved out a niche peopled by tragic gangsters, loose women, and more generally, the common man. Movies that were darker and more low down.
They made movies about all kinds of working class people. I mean, telephone repairmen were. On the other hand, they would do movies about the Ku Klux Klan, or about lynching in the South, or about maybe the greatest they ever did, I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. It's about a guy that's unjustly put on a chain gang in the South.
Now, that's a movie that actually a lot of people won't know unless they're
they should.
It was very dark. It had nothing remotely resembling a happy ending.
It ends in complete darkness. I mean, you know, Paul Muni. His girlfriend asks him, what do you do, how do you live? And it goes to blackness, and his reply is said over total black. He says, I steal. You know, that's the end of the movie.
I can't let you go like this. Can't you tell me where you're going? Do you need any money? How do you live?
I steal.
You get the impression there is no hope.
Well, Warner Brothers, that was the other unique thing. They were never afraid of the miserable ending, you know. People would get dead. All the time in Warner Brothers movies. That was not true of other studios. I mean, it's very interesting, and, you know, it's hard to say why they were so acceptant of death, doom, and destruction at the end of their movie.
The Warner Brothers. Why were they? They were hands-on running the studio.
I don't think for the last 20 years they ever spoke to each other except in anger. I mean, they all hated each other. Jack and Harry in particular, because Jack was kind of a dandy, kind of a womanizer, loved to sing and dance and tell terrible jokes. And Harry was a believing Jew, you know, he kept kosher, he was very conservative. I mean, stories, Harry chasing Jack around the lot with a lead pipe, trying to hit him.
You're through. You hire these mugs, they miss, now you're through. If you ain't out of town by tomorrow morning, you won't never leave it except in a pine box.
Just talk momentarily about the stars. One of the things that Warner Brothers was doing differently was putting mugs and floozies played by people who were not glamorous.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, someone talking about Edward G. Robinson, and he says he looks like a mud turtle. And he does. You know, he's not a handsome man. Jimmy Cagney's not a handsome guy.
Could you let me have a dime for a cup of coffee?
There's a buck. Buy yourself a percolator.
These guys were attractive for their energy and their sexiness derived from that.
Well, they also Bette Davis.
Bette Davis would not have been a star at MGM. She could act beautiful. You know what I mean? She carried herself in ways. I'm important, I'm significant, I'm somebody to reckon with.
They're coming to a tree in the middle of the road. We're taking it. If you're killed, I'll be free. If I'm killed, it really doesn't matter. If we both die, good riddance.
Good? You've taken everything out of my life? I don't want that without you. Go ahead, crash it.
You know, clearly Warner Brothers has a huge range of films that it's put out over these 8.5 decades.
Yeah.
But one of the signatures is the working guy. Yet in the late 40s, Warner Brothers ran into quite a bit of trouble with its own workers.
Oh, well, there was a gigantic strike here after the war. Yeah, tear gas was fired. People were beaten up. Pretty vicious strikes. And that really turned the Warners to a much more Republican point of view. And, you know, when the HUAC hearings came along,
House
on American Activities Committee, I mean, Jack was pleased to go down and testify. And he said he and his brothers would be pleased to subscribe to a fund that would send all these people back where they belong, namely Russia. Jack was not a totally subtle political mind. Except, of course, when it came to the politics of his own studio, where he's very subtle.
Jack Warner's savviness allowed him to steer his studio through the precipitous drop in movie audiences with the rise of TV in the 50s and the breakup of the studio system. Richard Schickel chronicles the studio's 85-year history in a series beginning next week on PBS and the book that goes along with it. They're both called You Must Remember This, after one of the greatest romances in Hollywood history, and typical of Warner Brothers, one without a happy ending.
Those three dormer kind of windows up there. In there is where Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, they're in Paris. She has that line, you hear some cannon fire.
Is there cannon fire? Or is it my heart pounding?
And then they kind of track back out the window. But that is the last little tiny bit of Casablanca that's left on the lot. That's the last memory of that movie.
From the newsroom to the screening room now, and filmmaker Wayne Wang. His specialty? The friction produced when cultures collide. His first feature, Chan is Missing, followed a pair of cabbies trying to negotiate San Francisco's Chinatown. His breakout, The Joy Luck Club, traced the intertwined histories of four women born in America and their mothers in China. This fall, Wayne Wang takes on clashing cultures with an unusual double feature of new movies. Beth Accomando of member station KPBS has the story.
Back in the 80s, filmmaker Wayne Wang exacted sly humor from the struggles of his fellow Chinese-American immigrants. Learning a new language and navigating a cultural minefield of miscommunication provided rich material for the young filmmaker. But now, a more mature Wang sees cross-cultural misunderstandings occurring within the Asian community and across generations. Wang found the perfect vehicle to explore these themes in a pair of short stories by Yiyun Li that span three generations of Chinese immigrants. In the first film, A Thousand Years of Good Prayers, a father visits his adult daughter in California. They may share a common language, but they cannot communicate.
I'm perfectly fine, but I'm doing well.
You know, the father and the daughter are from two different generations. The father went through the Cultural Revolution and specifically suffered a lot of injustices during that time, and the daughter was very much affected by it.
Wayne Wang says the daughter has come to America to distance herself from her past in China.
She learned a new language and a new culture and became a new person. And she learned how to express herself actually more.
A Thousand Years of Good Prayers focuses on a Chinese immigrant who's been living in the U.S. for years. But the second film, Princess of Nebraska, looks to a much younger immigrant who's just arrived in the U.S. Sasha lands in San Francisco with plans to get an abortion. She speaks English and is quite westernized in her behavior, attitude, and clothes. At a dinner party, the older Chinese Americans question her about her homeland.
I was recently speaking to some 20-year-old female students from Beida, And I asked him about the Tiananmen Square incident with the tank men, and they knew nothing about it. Isn't that amazing?
Sasha, do you remember the tank man?
I heard a little from my grandmother.
Sasha, what do you do?
Precisely what you think.
And that is?
Nothing.
Nothing? Tell us, what does that mean?
Mind your own business.
These new films return Wayne Wang to his indie roots. He spent the last decade making formulaic Hollywood films, such as Made in Manhattan and Last Holiday. But it's Wang's independent films, such as Chan is Missing and Smoke, that made him a role model for aspiring Asian-American filmmakers.
I think I'm just a bad influence, where all these young kids think, oh, I can go into filmmaking and make a lot of money, and then they they quit their real jobs, you know?
My real job at Costco. Yeah.
That's Richard Wong. He's the 32-year-old filmmaker that Wang tapped to co-direct and shoot the second film, Princess of Nebraska. Having two generations of filmmakers behind the camera brought depth to the generational clashes in the movie Princess of Nebraska, says Richard Wong.
When I read the script, all I really saw was this spoiled brat who, for the first time in her life, is forced to actually make a decision because she can't get away with a pregnancy, whereas, you know, she steals something, but she kind of just could weasel her way through. I certainly related to that because, I think a lot of us growing up were that way.
But Wayne Wang is a longtime cultural observer who's been making films about Chinese immigrants for more than 20 years. So Wang sees Sasha's particular experiences as part of the larger and ever-changing immigrant community.
You know, she's in her 20s. She's grew up in the last 20 years of China's economic boom and also the sexual revolution, too. I mean, she slept with a guy who's bisexual and she slept with him without knowing him very well and then got pregnant.
The way these two films will be released emphasizes even more the differences between the generations. Magnolia Pictures releases A Thousand Years of Good Prayers in theaters this month. Princess of Nebraska will be available on YouTube in October. That excites Richard Wong.
A Thousand Years is classical, and it's being distributed classically, and, you know, it's about an older generation, and it kind of just makes a lot of sense. And then the Princess is about a new generation. It's shot in a very contemporary way, and it makes sense for that to go to the internet.
Both Wayne Wang and Richard Wong hope that the innovative release strategy will provide a bridge across generations and cultures. For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
The movie business is not in as much trouble as some other businesses. Higher ticket prices mean that the take from the box office is healthy, although fewer people are going to the movies. They're staying home to do stuff like play video games or surf the internet. The studios are looking for a game changer, no pun intended, and as NPR's Kim Masters reports, they're hoping they will find it in 3D movies.
Jeffrey Katzenberg runs DreamWorks Animation, which brought you Shrek and Madagascar. But when he had his aha moment in 2004, he was watching a Warner Brothers movie.
Well, you coming?
Where?
Why, to the North Pole, of course! This is the Polar Express!
I walked out of that theater, I came in here the next day, and I said, our lives are going to be forever changed because this is the future for us.
And not just for DreamWorks Animation, he believes, but for movies generally. Katzenberg sees this as the third great revolution in the history of film.
The first is when movies went from silent films to talkies, and the second is when they went from black and white to color. And I believe what we are facing as an opportunity today is as great as either of those were. And in less than a handful of years, I think you will start to see the vast majority of movies will be made and shown in 3D.
It's something I believe is a needle mover.
Mike Campbell runs Regal Entertainment Group, which operates the largest theater chain in North America. He says 3D is already attracting people to theaters and they're willing to pay a premium for tickets. But he doesn't quite share Katzenberg's conviction.
I think you have to have, you know, the ability and the time for the audience to adjust. And whether they get to the point where everything is demanded in 3D or not, who's to say?
Few of Campbell's theaters are equipped for 3D, and that's because of money. It costs a lot to convert to digital projection, and the 3D equipment adds to the tab. theater owners say studios should pay, at least for the basic digital setup, because studios will save millions per movie when they no longer have to make prints. The studios are finally beginning to agree, and Katzenberg says theater owners are starting to see that they should help pay for upgrades too. He says 3D offers an immersive experience, and theater owners need to compete with what you might have in your living room.
Flat screen TVs, high definition, Blu-ray, stereo sound. I mean, you know, what you can see and experience in your own living room today is unbelievable compared to 10 years ago.
But many doubt that 3D will ever become the standard. Among them is an ardent fan of the technology, Daniel Smith. He works in visual effects and has a blog called 3D Fool. He says 3D should be used only when it's appropriate, not for cheap visual tricks, but to draw the viewer into a magical world, as it did in that 3D version of Polar Express.
That was a much superior film in 3D than it was in 2D.
If every story is told in 3D, he says,
it loses its specialness, it loses its freshness.
Smith thinks most films won't have a reason to be made in 3D, and many filmmakers won't have the budget to tell stories that way. Katzenberg says similar arguments were made with the advent of sound and color.
There were doubters, there were debaters, there were people that thought that they were gimmicks, fads that would come and go, they'd be the hula hoop. They weren't.
In the year ahead, two big 3D events are on the horizon. Katzenberg's animated film, Monsters vs. Aliens, opens next spring. James Cameron's highly anticipated science fiction film, Avatar, arrives in December 2009. Katzenberg believes there will be more than 5,000 theaters ready to show Avatar in 3D. But Mike Campbell thinks it will take several years to get to that number. He expects his chain, the biggest in the country, to have about 1,500 of its theaters converted over the next 3 to 4 years. Kim Masters, NPR News.
3D might be the future of movies, but this weekend's releases include a movie genre from the past. Kenneth Turan has a review of a Western, Appaloosa.
Few movie sounds are more appealing than pounding hoofbeats heard before the opening credits. A Western is about to start, and if everything goes right, nothing can be better than that. Appaloosa, the latest film to begin with that stirring sound, has done a lot of things right, but not everything. It respects Western movie tradition, and it co-stars Ed Harris, who also directs, and Viggo Mortensen. Both are excellent as the kind of tough, laconic, unflappable men Westerns could not exist without. These two are partners in a lawmen-for-hire operation. If your town is a mess, you hand it over, they clean it up, and move on. As one of them puts it, "I don't kill people for a living. I enforce the law. Killing is sometimes a byproduct." In the New Mexico town of Appaloosa, the team ends up negotiating with the inevitable psychotic rancher played by Jeremy Irons.
We need to make an arrangement.
There's a set of bylaws posted right outside the door here of this very saloon. Your boys do like the bylaws say everything will be muy bueno. And if they don't, I arrest them. And if they don't go along, I shoot them.
The real love match of this film is between the two lawmen. So it's unfortunate that a train rolls into Appaloosa one day and brings to town a young widow, played by Renee Zellweger. She arrives with an extensive wardrobe, some piano-playing skills, and little else. Given the marked lack of piano-playing women with extensive wardrobes in Appaloosa, the two lawmen are both smitten with the newcomer, something they live to regret. Audiences will regret it too. The widow is unconvincing as the object of multiple attractions because she exudes the charm and seductiveness of a potato casserole. This woman is so irritating, it's difficult to focus on the rest of the film. All the pounding hoofbeats in the world can't make up for that.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
He's been a troubled painter, an astronaut, and a famous composer, and now actor Ed Harris takes on the role of a gun-toting town marshal in his new film, Appaloosa. Harris plays Virgil Cole, who's brought in with his partner, Hitch, played by Viggo Mortensen, to deal with a band of outlaws led by Jeremy Irons.
There's a set of bylaws posted right outside the door here of this very saloon. Your boys do like the bylaws say everything will be muy bueno. And if they don't, I arrest them. And if they don't go along, I shoot them. Or Mr. Hitch does. That's the law. Your law. The same thing.
Ed Harris not only stars in the film, he also co-wrote the screenplay and he directed Appaloosa. He joins us now here in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome, Alex. Nice to be here.
I have read that you are the type of actor who does a fair amount of study into the roles that you play. This film was set in 1882. What kind of research did you do, both as an actor and as a director?
There's a wealth of material, obviously, from that period of time. Any number of books written about, you know, the settling of the West, or this was kind of post-settling. It was actually near the end of the Wild West, quote-unquote. So, there's wonderful photographs and lots of literature. So, of course, I was reading and reading and reading. And, you look at the photographs and, you know, life was hard and dusty and tough and day-to-day. And I really wanted to immerse myself in the genre more or less because I wanted the film to have a more of a classic feel than any attempt at modernization, really.
I was reading that your co-star Viggo Mortensen was a little bit worried about the heaviness of the guns that you were toting around. Did you actually shoot those guns, and what was that like?
Well, the script is based on a novel by Robert Parker of the same name, Appaloosa, which was published in 2005. And in the story, Everett Hitch, who Viggo plays, carries around this 8-gauge shotgun, which is a huge gun that he has had since he rode shotgun for Wells Fargo. Prior to our getting together, the two of us who've been riding together for some dozen years or so. And, you know, Viggo got a hold of the gun and he's going, am I supposed to carry this around with me all the time? And I go, well, yeah, you know. I said, see how it goes first couple of days. And it didn't take him long for it to become his best pal, really. You know, he handles it great. I mean, Viggo was a very detailed, very specific actor, you know, and he was really prepared. And he and his big shotgun got along great after a couple of days.
You surrounded yourself with people that you've worked with before, people that you know quite well, including your dad, who plays a cameo role. What's that like, directing your father?
Well, I actually think it's more than a cameo. I'm not sure what the definition of a cameo is, but he plays the judge.
Key role.
Yeah, he plays the judge in a rather important scene. And, once I get my dad to hear me, he doesn't hear real well. He was great, man. I was so proud of him. I almost burst into tears. I'd worked with him in some other films, and he's done a lot of theater in the Chicago area, community theater kind of stuff, and he was pretty excited about doing this. And he just really, he found a place in inside himself where he was real still and knew what he wanted to do, and he really nailed it. You know, he's going to be 86 in October, and he's doing good.
Let's take a listen to a scene from the film. In this scene, you have Jeremy Irons' character, the bad guy. He's in jail, and a posse of his guys show up with their guns trying to free him.
We know you're good, Cole, but you're not as good as 20 of us.
You know the arrangement, boy. First one of you does an ineluctable thing.
You shoot him, you think we're just gonna ride away?
Nope.
We'll kill you and Hitch.
You'll try.
You're willing to die to keep us from taking him?
Sure.
Hitch, you willing to die too?
Of course he's willing to die. You think we do this kind of work because we're scared to die? You?
Me?
You afraid to die?
I ain't afraid.
Good, because you go first.
Back in those days, the career options were a lot more limited. And I'm curious if you kind of envision yourself as Ed Harris back in 1882, what do you think you'd be doing for a living?
Well, I mean, a lot of guys, either shop owner or you're a farmer or you're on one side of the law or the other, if you're any good with a gun. And
any idea which side of the law you might fall on and whether or not you'd be carrying a gun for a living?
I would assume I would be carrying a gun. I don't know. I'd probably be on the side of the law, I guess. I don't know, Alex. That's a good question.
As if it weren't enough that you star in this film, you directed this film, you worked on the screenplay, just so happens you did something else for it. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we got like 6 minutes of credits, and so we wanted to, actually my Catherine Himoff, my editor, she introduced me to this Tom Petty song, which sounded really kind of cool, and thought it'd be kind of nice to hit the end credits with this Petty song. But then there was some more time left over on the credits, and Jeff Beal, who did a great job composing the music, we thought about reintroducing some of his theme music. And then I was up late one night and I wrote this song out and the lyrics to it, and then Jeff wrote the music to it. And I was over at his studio one day and we recorded me singing this thing, and I wasn't really thinking of putting it on the credits, but by popular demand, I did. And it's kind of a fun song, you know.
Mr. Harris, could I possibly persuade you to sing just a little bit of it for us?
Never thought I'd be a man that cares just like I do. I knew when I first saw you, my doubting days were through. You got a certain something I'd never dreamt before. I knew it was for real when you stepped inside that door. Side-eye goes on.
Ed Harris co-wrote, directed, stars, and sings in the new film Appaloosa. It opens this week in New York and Los Angeles and across the country next month. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Alex. Thanks for having me. I never thought I'd be a man that cares just like I do. I knew when I first saw you, my doubting days were through. You've got a certain something.
Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Madeline Brand.
You'll be the one who's leaving, 'cause you'll never leave my heart. And when the day does come, when you and I depart, you'll be the one who's leaving, 'cause you'll never leave my heart.
You can hear more stories about movies on our website, npr.org/movies.